Hello and welcome to ESIPE Global Economy Podcast. I'm not Frederik Eriksson, the usual host of the podcast. My name is Oscar Gini. I'm a senior economist at ESIPE, and today I'm very pleased to welcome Peter Garicano to talk about EU competitiveness. Peter is the co-author of Silicon Continent, a weekly blog trying to understand why the EU economy is falling behind. It is an excellent blog, and I recommend everyone listening to the podcast to sign up for Peter's blog in Substack. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Great. So, on the 29th of January, the European Commission published its competitiveness compass. Don't get too excited about traveling, because the competitiveness compass is a policy document where the European Commission presents a number of strategies and regulations that aim to raise Europe's competitiveness. So, Peter, if you will have to mark the competitiveness compass between zero being completely awful and 10 being the best policies that you can think of to boost the competitiveness of the European economy, which score will you give?
I think I'd probably assign it whatever the lowest possible passing grade is, right? Like a 5.5 or a 6 out of 10. I think that the big strength of the compass, what you see, is that they acknowledge that growth is a priority, that growth is a kind of a necessary condition to preserving the kind of European way of life, to preserving our societies as they exist today. And they make a very strong case for growth and the factors that underpin it, which is not a thing you should take for granted, given that this is the same Commission president who no more than 2 years ago spoke at a degrowth conference that they organized in the European Parliament. And so that bit is very heartening, and it's a good step. Unfortunately, the actual substantive policies of the competitive compass don't necessarily indicate that they both have a lot of meat, muscle behind them, and that they've understood what tactically are the right steps to take to increase growth. And so, like, lowest passing grade, 5.5 out of 10.
Very good, very good. Well, if you're a policymaker listening to this in Brussels, you get a 5/6/10. That's not bad. But you have published a blog about, so this is, the title is something like 20 Thoughts on the Competitiveness Compass. So let's get a bit more detail on this. We don't have time to discuss the 20 points, but what are your three main criticisms of the compass?
If you have to kind of boil it down to three, the first one has to be workability, right? So the compass itself doesn't come with money assigned to programs. In fact, probably the best policy in the competitive compass is this 28th legal regime, right? They acknowledge that employment law, taxation, and labor law, bankruptcy law, are all disrupting the ability of EU startups to scale. And so they say what we want to do is standardize these things across the EU, right? Create what they call a 28th regime. But there is no indication within the compass, first of all, that the member states are willing to hand over this amount of power to the Commission. And second of all, this 28th legal regime mentions this thing of, or it mentions it's going to be for innovative companies, whatever that means. And that kind of implies that that there's going to be thresholds for this, that some smaller firms, perhaps what they call startups in Europe, is going to have right to having this 28th legal regime, but actually if you're a larger company, you won't. What it does is it does the same thing every other EU law does, which it keeps firms small. And so that's like the first thing, like, is it workable? The second problem is that the compass continues to pretend that trade-offs don't exist, right? So one of the big problems with EU growth politics, or we might even say European politics in general, is that we think we can have it all, right? We think we can have, you know, peace without investing in defense. We think we can have growth without liberalizing our economies. And the compass does this again, right? The compass says, for example, decarbonization is the way to drive growth. I think it's like almost explicit quote. And they say in their accompanying FT op-ed, they say only by pursuing net zero renewable carbon, renewable energy strategies, can we secure cheap and secure electricity. And those two things, like renewable energies, like, great thing, like, we should aim for, reducing carbon emissions. But we should be honest about the fact that reducing carbon emissions is going to probably lead to a high energy price. Like, trade-offs are real, and trade-offs should be acknowledged. And the document doesn't do as if trade-offs exist. And the third thing, very briefly, that I think is an issue with this compass, is that it continues to go down the path of believing that it's the government's policies that drive growth rather than private sector enterprise, right? So they have this extremely brilliant line where they say, it says the bioeconomy is the economy of the future, and how they're going to fix this? Well, they say the EU bioeconomy strategy will position the EU with significant growth potential in bio-based materials, right? So this is like a magical strategy. Rather than thinking, what are the things we can do to make our bio companies work better? They say, the way we're fixing this is by coming up with a strategy. And you see this everywhere else. Like, their big plan to save EU heavy industry is announcing more action plans, an action plan for steel, an action plan for chemicals. And so what you're seeing is this continued idea that the way we're going to have growth is by bureaucrats coming up with like 10-step plans for growth, rather than saying, okay, we're going to acknowledge that, like, we need broad-based liberalization to let private enterprise, drive prosperity.
Very good. So basically, if I could summarize your three points, first of all, is the 28th regime that you see as a positive but not easy to work out. Second is magic thinking, and the third one will be kind of a Brexit complex of having your cake and eat it, that you point out on energy. And energy is the next question, because higher energy costs are one of Europe's comparative disadvantages. But at the same time, there is and there has been a lot of investment in renewable energy. So my question is, how do you explain that on one hand, Europeans invest so much on energy production, and on the other hand, they get some of the most expensive energy bills among the rich countries?
So this, at least as far as when in our process of writing and researching for these essays we write, this does seem to be in part due to the investment in like intermittent renewables, right? So like here's a stylized fact, which is that since 2000, roughly, since the last 20 years, Germany has grown its nominal capacity by 60%. It's invested $500 billion, in energy transition. Capacity is up, but generation has gone up just 5%, and prices are much higher than they were 24 years ago, right? So what explains that? And it seems to be that a lot of the investment is in renewables whose utilization rate, their capacity rate, which is like how often are you actually utilizing them, is much, much lower. So I just checked the dashboard just before entering this podcast. Right now, for wind power in Europe, the utilization rate onshore is like roughly 22%. So if you have a rated maximum output of, 10 gigawatts, and this is what they announced, they say, we're building a offshore wind park, which is going to provide X hundred megawatts of power. Well, right now you're just producing 10 to 20% of that. And in Germany right now, right, the current energy mix, like as we are recording this podcast, they're generating four times as much power using gas as they are using solar and wind combined. And so you've invested an immense amount in power, but you've done most of it by ripping out existing capacity and replacing it with capacity which is very intermittent, and so thus leads to very, very high like price variability. And to give you a sense of how extreme this can get, in the UK, of course, not in the EU, but very similar situation. Just 2 weeks ago, they came within 500 megawatts out of roughly 50 gigawatts of utilization. So we're talking about 1% of total power usage at the time, within 500 megawatts of a blackout because there was solar shortages. And the marginal price at which they were generating additional power was 5 euros per kilowatt hour. We're talking about almost 25 times the normal price for power in the UK. And so it seems to be, to answer your question, to push back to what you're asking, we've invested a lot of money, but we've invested in replacing old baseload capacity with new intermittent capacity. This doesn't mean we have to let go of the green agenda, but we need to focus on baseload, nuclear. What does actually investing in storage look like? And how do we rapidly scale up like fission plants?
Yeah. So your point is that when we substitute base capacity with renewables, what we have is higher variability of prices. And if we know something from business schools or university in general, is that businesses don't like uncertainty and don't right. like this variability, which is and the ones, I mean, the business, the industries that will be affected the most by higher energy prices are energy intensive industries.
Yes.
So we all think, when we think about these industries, we all think about mining, steel, or chemicals, kind of traditional industries. But there are also, you know, that will also, these higher energy prices also can have an effect on the industries of tomorrow, which are also energy intensive, right?
No, certainly. I mean, the most obvious example here is data centers. And data centers are a really interesting example. Von der Leyen in the competitiveness compass, they actually announce we have to build an AI gigafactory for frontier models. And so that's a very maximalist approach to AI. We really embrace that we have to be, you know, doing our, be, you know, to be on the cutting edge, both in the software and algorithm side, but clearly also in the hardware side, in the data center side. And it turns out that for data centers, the big constraint, apart from obviously availability of compute, of chips, is power. And it's not so much power price, because a lot of these like very big companies are quite price insensitive, as power availability, right? So out of your operating costs, this is according to SemiAnalysis, which is the best, you know, data center research firm. Out of your operating costs for a data center, roughly 80% of the costs are power. But because the data center is so capital intensive, because most of your cost is just upfront buying the chips and buying the chips, it means that actually out of the total cost of ownership, power is a very small share. So it's not so much that you care about the power price as much as you care about having power consistently, because you can't afford to have downtime. So that means for data centers, you want to have very predictable, very available, very large amounts of like multiple gigawatts available all the time for these very, very big frontier data centers. And what you see is that availability of power is a big problem in Europe right now, right? So let me give you an example of the Netherlands, which is where I'm from. The Netherlands has a lot of traditional data centers because it was these big transatlantic computing nodes. There's all kinds of financial services there as well and telecoms. And the Netherlands currently has a complete ban, a moratorium, with the exception of one location or two locations for data centers over 70 megawatts, because there's no power availability. And they realized that we could, you know, reroute power to data centers if we wanted to, but that means that consumers face higher prices and consumers don't like that. And so de facto, when it comes to data centers, it's really hard to build them in Europe because of a lack of power availability. Now, the kind of the slide aside here is that we have lots of nuclear coming offline, particularly in Germany, right? We're talking about 10 gigawatts in Germany, 10.7, I think they could bring back within a short number of years. And so that's the kind of thing that if you were thinking about amping up baseload and also driving down emissions, that's a complete no-brainer. There's a guy called Mark Nelson. He recently received a grant. He's a very brilliant American energy guy who's trying to work on bringing back nuclear to Germany. And he's done the research here, and he says 2 or 3 years for 10 gigawatts of power. The last thing I'll say about this is that it's not immediately clear that you actually want to have data centers. At least it depends on whether you... how much stock it seems you place on national security, right? Like, it's clear that data centers are important for like sovereignty, right? That you don't want to get expropriated. You don't want to have your data be transferred to another country. You might think that, you know, having control over your own AI, whatever that means, is very important. And so having your data centers might be important for national security. But like, notwithstanding that, imagine that we're building data centers in Canada. It might be the case that like having a kind of like an FDI model where like European firms are building their compute abroad, that doesn't necessarily seem like a very big problem. It can be just a question of comparative advantage. The one caveat I'll place to that about whether it's okay to have your data centers abroad is that it seems that for some uses, like say like voice, so like AI agents, if we were talking like this on a podcast, except instead of you and me, it would be to me talking to the advanced voice mode of OpenAI. That in that case, latency really matters. If latency matters, you might want to have more local computing taking place. So yes, for industries of tomorrow, data centers in particular, the lack of power is a huge problem, but it's not immediately unambiguous that we actually need to be the ones placing them in Europe.
Very good. So we have kind of started with energy, then we moved to data centers, and you have at the very end of your answer alluded to regulation. Yes. Which is going to be kind of the next kind of part of the podcast. So let's turn a focus to one of the leitmotifs of your blog, which is the productivity gap between the EU and the US in information and communication technology, ICT. And in the description of your blog, you have a quote from Draghi, from the Draghi report, which says that the productivity gap between the EU and the US is largely explained by the technology sector. And this, the EU is weak in emerging technologies that will drive future growth. That's the end of the quote.
Yeah.
So my question is, why is Europe's productivity in the ICT sector lower than the productivity of the ICT sector in America?
So one story you can tell here is that it has a lot to do with scale and winner-take-all dynamics, right? So like, what are the things that characterize the ICT sector in particular? Well, one feature is that it's basically all the costs are upfront, right? Like you have your fixed cost of like, you know, writing your software or like building your data centers, but the marginal cost of having additional users is quite low. And so like being scale is very important. It's very very strong returns to scale. And the flip side is for the same reason, and for reasons like imperfect substitution, for most users will cluster, and of course network effects as well, most users will cluster around the very best products, right? All of us use Google, all of us use WhatsApp. It means that a very small number of firms basically serve the entire market and are responsible, for example, for like, you know, in the case of AI, three labs, which employ like 0.2% of the tech workforce in the US, do all the AI advances, right? Or one firm, NVIDIA, is responsible for like 95% of AI chip design. That's to say that being the best, like there is really important. Like scale is a really, really important factor of leadership in ICT or leadership in tech. And Europe has created the conditions such that it's very hard to scale up a firm. The conventional, things you'll hear from tech sector have to do with, like, say, capital availability. They'll say, you know, Solvency II requirements mean that it's bad for pension firms to give money to VC funds. These things are true. But one theory, which is more fundamental, which I think is very convincing, comes from Olivier Coste, who has this idea of failure costs, right? He says that fundamentally, the employment innovating in tech is a very inherently very risky business. He says roughly, you know, 80% of all like in-house, you know, tech ventures fail. And so the firms that do well are the firms that can easily take risks and then take the hit if the product fails. So what do I mean by this? Well, for example, you have a story like Apple with its driverless car. Apple spent, you know, I don't know, a decade working on a driverless car. It didn't work. And they recently laid off the entire team. They just got rid of the team. They realized it doesn't work and they just closed shop. And the costs of doing so for a US firm of closing shop and doing something else are very, very low. And he calls these costs failure costs. And the failure costs mostly are have to do with the costs of like restructuring and like employment protection. And he says the statistics he finds in his paper roughly that the heuristic is the cost of restructuring in the US is roughly a tenth of the cost of restructuring in Europe. And so that means across the board, every time we're talking about a medium-sized firm getting larger or a large firm getting super large, every time they have to like innovate to stay on top, their costs, their risks are much, much lower in the United States. And so they're much more likely to make that choice. And if you look at these, like if we take this theory and apply it to these like super cap tech companies, right, these very big US giants, it kind of seems true, right? Like Google didn't necessarily just do the search engine. They brought in AdSense, they brought in Android, they brought in YouTube. And these are all like very big like revenue drivers for them. If we look at, for example, Microsoft currently gets more revenue from its cloud computing service than it gets from its Windows OS. And so a lot of these like very, very, very large companies have reinvented themselves many times. And this basic theory is that more flexible employment law and more flexible like capital markets, more flexible bankruptcy law all make it the case that reinventing yourself in Europe is simply more expensive. Sorry, reinventing yourself in the US is less expensive and in Europe it's more expensive. And so that's one theory for why we're falling behind.
Well, let me say that and put a bit of advertising here for ESIP itself, that quite recently, we did an event with Olivier, and it was excellent. And I recommend everyone to go to our website and watch the event. And I suppose it will also be published as a podcast here. Yes, I think you make a fundamental point here, which kind of connects with your criticism of the competitiveness compass, which is about that European policy. So there's been an obsession of whether Europe should have a European Google. But I think we go about it in the wrong way. We go about it in the way of that we can design, we can select a company, give it a lot of money, and create a European champion. When, and this is also part of Oliver's way of thinking, is that, and many others too, that we should focus on the conditions, on the horizontal conditions for these kind of companies to emerge. That is the question. Why it hasn't emerged rather than
right.
Europe creating artificially from top down by subsidizing or providing government money. So hovering about this conversation during the whole time, it's been the topic of industrial policy. Industrial policy has moved from being known as the Voldemort policy, the policy that cannot be named, to a must-have for each government. Let's now assume that our definition of industrial policy, which is not set in stone, but let's assume for the sake of the argument, that is one that includes all public policies that incentivize an economy to move towards a desired state of production. And traditionally, this has been activities with higher productivity, from agriculture to manufacturing and so on. But they can be activities with lower carbon intensity or boosting the defense sector. And the EU has embraced industrial policy, and it is opened about promoting certain sectors or technologies over others, and also secure supplies. So my question is pretty broad. Peter, what is your take on Europe's industrial policy? What is right? What is wrong?
It's a very interesting question. Of course, an extremely salient topic at the moment. It seems that, and we wrote a piece on the Substack, which was titled like, will Europe be able to save its car industry? Right? Because that's like a great example of like an industry we were desperate to save. And the two things, and in it, we cite this literature review by Danny Roderick from last year about what characterizes successful industrial policy. And he basically identifies two things that make industrial policy work. One is that you have to be willing to let the losers fail, right? So rather than choosing firms you want to win, you have to choose industries you think are important, or like certain goods you think are important, and subsidize those. But you cannot be like choosing actual firms themselves is recipe for like rent seeking and inefficiency, and you create an interest group which is very potent, and eventually you're just throwing good money after bad. And so you have to be kind of willing to let like losers die, and you have to become a bit ruthless with the industrial policy. The second part that they identify is that you have to have a clear objective, or one objective and one instrument, right? Or at least that you zero trade-off, like industrial policy is trying to do all of the above, will usually end up doing either none of the things or definitely not the most important thing you want to be doing, right? So like if you, and this is a very like big topic in the US right now, we have the CHIPS Act. The CHIPS Act also did all kinds of like democratic policy priorities. It provided childcare. It did like, equity and social programs. And so what's the result of that? Well, the result of that is you get less chips. And so your industrial policy is very inefficient. So let me give like a counterintuitive example of a country that's actually doing industrial policy about as well as like a good like liberal economist wanted to do, which is China, right? So what's the story with China and EVs? I got to write a paper about this last year, which was quite interesting. The story with China and EVs is that roughly 20 years ago, they decide that they won't catch up with hybrid, they won't catch up with ICE, and so electric vehicles is the next big thing. They call them NEVs. And in 2007, I think they released a plan, I think it's actually a five-year plan, where they mention that Chinese leadership in EVs is the big priority. And so how do they do it? Well, the first thing they do is they don't actually pick winners, right? So they do consumer subsidies. You know, you get a very big purchase credit. They do favorable access to financing. But the EV market is extraordinarily competitive. I think at the peak of the EV market, there were roughly 500 companies vying to be Chinese EV firms. And that dropped down to one, like, I think now it's like 100 and something. I mean, that could be wrong. But in any case, you know, between 60 and 80% of Chinese EV firms have gone bankrupt. And so rather than like choosing a big state champion, what we'd expect of like a communist system, they said, we will subsidize this market because we think it's important. We think it's like a very important, like very strong spillovers, and it's like important for like national security, but we're not going to be choosing winners and losers. We're going to say you can vie and be competitive. And the second part of this, I think it's really quite surprising for Europeans to hear, is one of the ways they make their market more competitive is by letting foreign competitors enter, right? So the single largest recipient of EV subsidies in China, at least consumer subsidies, I think for a very long time, is Tesla. And Tesla, there's a great quote where the Shanghai party secretary, when they're discussing whether to let Tesla build a factory in China, he says, "We must let Tesla in. Tesla is the catfish that will make our companies swim faster." And so that's the second thing they did, right? Second thing they did is allow foreign competition, right, to make sure the market's efficient. The third thing they did was investing in upstream R&D. This is batteries in particular. Lithium-ion batteries have been like the industry standard for a very long time, and China has gone all in on lithium iron batteries, so LFP batteries, and they're world leaders in that. And the fourth thing they did was use public procurement to kind of cross the valley of death initially. They had these LFP batteries, which weren't very good at the start. The range was very short. But if it's the state which is buying the products, that means that the state has very different purposes than the consumer. And so, for example, they would have like electric buses or electric taxis for running on these new batteries, which meant they created a pretty strong initial market an advanced market commitment for the companies who are innovating in lithium iron batteries, these new batteries. And so that's like a pretty textbook case of like what does good industrial policy look like. If we apply this framework to Europe, what do we see? Well, Europe's industrial policy doesn't seem to be about letting losers fail, right? Like when we're talking about industrial policy in EVs, we're talking about saving Volkswagen, we're talking about saving Renault, rather than saying we want to have an EV industry and we don't really care what it looks like. When we talk about having an EV industry, we're also talking about like saving the jobs, right? It's not about we have this criterion of you need to have one objective and one instrument, but really, when it comes to EV, with the car industry, for example, we're trying to optimize for a lot of things. We're trying to optimize perhaps for emissions, but not really because we're not letting in Chinese cars. We're trying to optimize for innovation, but not really because we're actually only saving the incumbents rather than helping startups. And we're also optimizing very obviously for like employment. We're trying to protect these firms from dying. And it means that that the industrial policy is going to be less successful than it otherwise would be. It's going to actually not achieve its stated objectives and going to lead to inefficiencies and rent seeking. And like if you had a not textbook way, like an inverse textbook way of doing industrial policy, choosing a big national champion and throwing money at them is probably what that looks like.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you. And I think you had done something that very few have done before, which is actually to connect or show what Chinese industrial policy and US industrial policy have in common, which is that both of them, the subsidies, the consumer subsidies you referred to, and also the tax cuts from the Inflation Reduction Act, what they do is they give a price to a company when the price has succeeded. So they don't need to choose the winner. There is a self-selection there. And as you said, in Europe, we go about it in a different way. We select the company that receives the subsidy. And many times we just select a failing company, which is also connected to Oliver Costa's thinking and what you have explained very well in the previous answer about the cost of failure, because that the cost of failure is about creative destruction and allowing companies to transform and moving from one sector to the other, because reinvention is better than bankruptcy. Right. And in that sense, we need to, an ideal industrial policy will be one that will allow companies to actually do that.
Right, exactly. And to tie it together to what you asked about originally, right, which is like ICT productivity in the future, if a progress in AI is anything like what people who are close to it think it's going to be like, right? So for example, I just came back from San Francisco this weekend, and like people who work at these AI labs genuinely believe that they will be out of a job in 3 or 4 years. Like this is an entirely serious, like they will straight face tell you that I, as a computer software engineer, like a software engineer, will not be useful in any way in 3 years. If like that prognosis is even like, you know, 2 or 3 times as optimistic as the truth, right? If we take a really bearish assessment of like we think AI progress is going to be a bit slower than they say it is, it's still going to be extraordinarily disruptive. And it means that that firms will have to adjust and restructure a lot very quickly, right? And we saw this already with US tech firms, right? US tech firms have fired 10-15% of their workforces in the last 2 or 3 years. And so the stakes when it comes to being like agile and being able to like very rapidly scale and deploy new products and also cut them loose if they fail, the stakes are going to rise in the future rather than decline. It's going to be more rather than less important that our companies can take risks. They can try things out, deploying new AI systems, and also just decide to let them go if they don't work. And that's right now the primary thing that we're really getting wrong.
And this is pretty worrying for the European industry itself, because in a way you are alluding. I mean, if you agree that a larger share of any industrial good will, the value added that comes from ICT will be higher.
Yep.
And then you have explained that in this particular sector there is a higher rate of economic dynamism, economic creative destruction, and so on. Europe's inability to restructure labor laws became a comparative disadvantage, right?
Yeah, exactly that. And of course, we haven't even talked about it on this podcast, but like we have tons of like AI specific or tech specific regulation, which worsens these things, right? Like GDPR, of course, is a great obstacle to small firms. I mean, the AI Act, which I've had the pleasure of like writing a few things about, is the AI Act basically is all about preventing the rollout of AI, right? So yeah. a quick example, like educational AI systems, which seem to be like one of the biggest use cases, right? It was just recently a paper that came out from Nigeria, where it turned out that students with access to a GPT tutor had like, I don't know, like 1 SD better performance in classes. Education is a use case where the EU AI Act basically makes it impossible because it's high risk. And so you have to go through like a 14-step plan. You have to do a bunch of risk assessments. You have to do like a fundamental rights risk assessment. You have to build security systems and designate a special EU representative. And what that means is that if you are a small startup trying to do education for AI for Europe, or if you're a major company, or if you are a public school system, it's just going to be extremely hard to make use of what's going to be probably the biggest single change to education in like last X millennia. And like one more example for me, I act because it's just so striking, right? So if you want to have a bank teller, so someone who's like a cashier at a bank, which is like AI, every time it recognizes a customer's face, which I assume is a very simple like AI use case, right? Just like the AI system sees you, recognizes you. That needs to be verified by at least 2 humans. So every time like an AI system like sees you and does biometric recognition, that's a high-risk use case, and so it requires 2 humans to verify that. And so what it means is that we have like a perfect storm of very poor like fundamentals in like bankruptcy law, employment law, like capital markets for like these firms in general. And then specifically when it comes to the rollout of tech, we've made it harder by tacking on the AI Act, by tacking on the GDPR, which means these firms really struggle with deployment and rollout. And it could lead to a very substantial like growth delta between us and at least between the Americans and the Europeans.
Yes, I mean this is an absolutely crucial point. And going back to the competitiveness compass, they have this. The competitiveness compass wants to reduce the regulatory burden in Europe. This is very good thing, But in a way, what is really critical, the critical effect of regulation on the economy is not so much the regulatory burden in terms of the amount of stamps you have to put in a paper, but the incentives that it creates for companies to do something or something else. And right. In this way, what the kind of the take on these digital regulations is that because they're making it more difficult to use data, more difficult to work on digital technologies, you are incentivizing your companies to do other things which are not digital. Now, you can import digital services from the US, let's say, but the truth of the matter is a lot of the technology and the productivity gains are coming from this particular sector. So you really want to have these companies, large or small or medium, in technology, because this is where the sources of new productivity gains are.
Yeah, no, definitely concur.
Great. Peter, it's been a real, real pleasure to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to reading your next Substack.
Thank you for having me.